Carlyle called. "Mrs. Carlyle," he said. He waited for whatever it was Mrs. Webster might say next. "Yes, I identified myself, but she didn't seem surprised to find me here. She said a few words to each of the children." Carlyle glanced at Keith and Sarah, but they weren't paying any attention. They were lining up cookies on another baking sheet. Mrs. Webster continued. "She left a message. Let me see, I wrote it down, but I think I can remember it. She said, 'Tell him, that is, tell you, what goes around comes around.' I think that's right. She said you'd understand." Carlyle stared at her. He heard Mr. Webster's truck outside. "That's Mr. Webster," she said, and took off the apron. Carlyle nodded. 7 o'clock in the morning?" she asked. "That will be fine," he said, "and thank you again." That evening he bathed each of the children, got them into their pajamas, and then read to them. He listened to their prayers, tucked in their covers, and turned out the light. It was nearly 9 o'clock. He made himself a drink and watched something on TV until he heard Carol's car pull into the drive. Around 10, while they were in bed together, the phone rang. He swore, but he didn't get up to answer it. It kept ringing.
"It might be important," Carol said, sitting up. "It might be my sitter. She has this number."
"It's my wife," Carlyle said. "I know it's her. She's losing her mind. She's going crazy. I'm not going to answer it."
"I have to go pretty soon anyway," Carol said. "It was real sweet tonight, honey." She touched his face.
It was the middle of the fall term. Mrs. Webster had been with him for nearly 6 weeks. During this time, Carlyle's life had undergone a number of changes. For one thing, he was becoming reconciled to the fact that Eileen was gone and, as far as he could understand it, had no intention of coming back. He stopped imagining that this might change. It was only late at night, on the nights he was not with Carol, that he wished for an end to the love he still had for Eileen and felt torment as to why all of this had happened. But for the most part, he and the children were happy. They thrived under Mrs. Webster's attentions. Lately she'd gotten into the routine of making their dinner and keeping it in the oven, warming, until his arrival home from school. He'd walk in the door to the smell of something good coming from the kitchen and find Keith and Sarah helping to set the dining-room table. Now and again he asked Mrs. Webster if she would care for overtime work on Saturdays. She agreed, as long as it wouldn't entail her being at his house before noon. Saturday mornings, she said, she had things to do for Mr. Webster and herself. On these days, Carol would leave Dodge with Carlyle's children, all of them under Mrs. Webster's care, and Carol and he would drive to a restaurant out in the country for dinner. He believed his life was beginning again. Though he hadn't heard from Eileen since that call 6 weeks ago, he found himself able to think about her now without either being angry or else feeling close to tears. At school, they were just leaving the medieval period and about to enter the Gothic. The Renaissance was still some time off, at least not until after the Christmas recess. It was during this time that Carlyle got sick. Overnight, it seemed, his chest tightened and his head began to hurt. The joints of his body became stiff. He felt dizzy when he moved around. The headache got worse. He woke up with it on a Sunday and thought of calling Mrs. Webster to ask her to come and take the children somewhere. They'd been sweet to him, bringing him glasses of juice and some soda pop, but he couldn't take care of them. On the second morning of his illness, he was just able to get to the phone to call in sick. He gave his name, his school, department, and the nature of his illness to the person who answered the number. Then he recommended Mel Fisher as his substitute.
Fisher was a man who painted abstract oils 3 or 4 days a week, 16 hours a day, but who didn't sell or even show his work. He was a friend of Carlyle's.
"Get Mel Fisher," Carlyle told the woman on the other end of the line.
"Fisher," he whispered. He made it back to his bed, got under the covers, and went to sleep. In his sleep, he heard the pickup engine running outside, and then the backfire it made as the engine was turned off. Sometime later, he heard Mrs. Webster's voice outside the bedroom door.
"Mr. Carlyle?"
"Yes, Mrs. Webster." His voice sounded strange to him. He kept his eyes shut.
"I'm sick today. I called the school. I'm going to stay in bed today." "I see. Don't worry, then," she said. "I'll look after things at this end."
He shut his eyes. Directly, still in a state between sleeping and waking, he thought he heard his front door open and close. He listened. Out in the kitchen, he heard a man say something in a low voice and a chair being pulled away from the table. Pretty soon he heard the voices of the children. Sometime later, he wasn't sure how much time had passed, he heard Mrs. Webster outside his door.
"Mr. Carlyle, should I call the doctor?"
"No, it's all right," he said. "I think it's just a bad cold, but I feel hot all over. I think I have too many covers, and it's too warm in the house. Maybe you'll turn down the furnace."
Then he felt himself drift back into sleep. In a little while, he heard the children talking to Mrs. Webster in the living room. Were they coming inside or going out? Carlyle wondered. Could it be the next day already? He went back to sleep. But then he was aware of his door opening. Mrs. Webster appeared beside his bed. She put her hand on his forehead.
"You're burning up," she said. "You have a fever."
"I'll be all right," Carlyle said. "I just need to sleep a little longer. And maybe you could turn the furnace down. Please, I'd appreciate it if you could get me some aspirin. I have an awful headache."
Mrs. Webster left the room, but his door stood open. Carlyle could hear the TV going out there.
"Keep it down, Jim," he heard her say,
and the volume was lowered at once. Carlyle fell asleep again. But he couldn't have slept more than a minute because Mrs. Webster was suddenly back in his room with a tray. She sat down on the side of his bed. He roused himself and tried to sit up. She put a pillow behind his back.
"Take these," she said, and gave him some tablets. "Drink this."
She held a glass of juice for him.
"I also brought you some cream of wheat. I want you to eat it. It'll be good for you."
He took the aspirin and drank the juice. He nodded, but he shut his eyes once more. He was going back to sleep.
"Mr. Carlyle," she said.
He opened his eyes.
"I'm awake," he said. "I'm sorry."
He sat up a little. "I'm too warm, that's all. What time is it? Is it 8:30 yet?"
"It's a little after 9:30," she said.
9:30, he said.
"Now, I'm going to feed this cereal to you, and you are going to open up and eat it. 6 bites, that's all. Here's the first bite. Open," she said. "You're going to feel better after you eat this. Then I'll let you go back to sleep. You eat this, and then you can sleep all you want."
He ate the cereal she spooned to him and asked for more juice. He drank the juice, and then he pulled down in the bed again. Just as he was going off to sleep, he felt her covering him with another blanket. The next time he awoke, it was afternoon. He could tell it was afternoon by the pale light that came through his window. He reached up and pulled the curtain back. He could see that it was overcast outside. The wintry sun was behind the clouds. He got out of bed slowly, found his slippers, and put on his robe. He went into the bathroom and looked at himself in the mirror. Then he washed his face and took some more aspirin. He used the towel and then went out to the living room.
On the dining room table, Mrs. Webster had spread some newspaper, and she and the children were pinching clay figures together. They had already made some things that had long necks and bulging eyes, things that resembled giraffes or else dinosaurs. Mrs. Webster looked up as he walked by the table.
"How are you feeling?"
Mrs. Webster asked him as he settled onto the sofa. He could see into the dining room area where Mrs. Webster and the children sat at the table.
"Better, thanks. A little better," he said. "I still have a headache, and I feel a little warm."
He brought the back of his hand up to his forehead.
"But I'm better. Yes, I'm better. Thanks for your help this morning."
"Can I get you anything now?"
Mrs. Webster said.
"Some more juice or some tea? I don't think coffee would hurt, but I think tea would be better. Some juice would be best of all."
"No, thanks," he said. "I'll just sit here for a while. It's good to be out of bed. I feel a little weak, is all."
"Mrs. Webster?" She looked at him and waited. "Did I hear Mr. Webster in the house this morning? It's fine, of course. I'm just sorry I didn't get a chance to meet him and say hello."
"It was him," she said. "He wanted to meet you, too. I asked him to come in. He just picked the wrong morning, what with you being sick and all. I wanted to tell you something about our plans, Mr. Webster's and mine, but this morning wasn't a good time for it."
"Tell me what," he said, alert, fear plucking at his heart. She shook her head.
"It's all right," she said. "It can wait."
"Tell him what?" Sarah said. "Tell him what?"
What?
Keith picked it up. The children stopped what they were doing.
"Just a minute, you two,"
Mrs. Webster said as she got to her feet.
"Mrs. Webster! Mrs. Webster!" Keith cried.
"Now, see here, little man," Mrs. Webster said. "I need to talk to your father. Your father is sick today. You just take it easy. You go on and play with your clay. If you don't watch it, your sister is going to get ahead of you with these creatures."
Just as she began to move toward the living room, the phone rang. Carlyle reached over to the end table and picked up the receiver. As before, he heard faint singing in the wire and knew that it was Eileen.
"Yes," he said. "What is it?"
"Carlyle," his wife said, "I know, don't ask me how, that things are not going so well right now. You're sick, aren't you? Richard's been sick, too. It's something going around. He can't keep anything on his stomach. He's already missed a week of rehearsal for this play he's doing. I've had to go down myself and help block out scenes with his assistant. But I didn't call to tell you that. Tell me how things are out there."
"Nothing to tell," Carlyle said. "I'm sick, that's all. A touch of the flu, but I'm getting better."
"Are you still writing in your journal?" she asked.
It caught him by surprise. Several years before, he'd told her that he was keeping a journal. "Not a diary," he'd said, "a journal." As if that explained something. But he'd never shown it to her, and he hadn't written in it for over a year. He'd forgotten about it.
"Because," she said, "you ought to write something in the journal during this period. How you feel and what you're thinking. You know, where your head is at during this period of sickness. Remember, sickness is a message about your health and your well-being. It's telling you things. Keep a record. You know what I mean? When you're well, you can look back and see what the message was. You can read it later, after the fact." "Colette did that," Eileen said, "when she had a fever this one time."
"Who?" Carlyle said. "What did you say?"
"Colette," Eileen answered. "The French writer. You know who I'm talking about. We had a book of hers around the house. Gigi or something. I didn't read that book, but I've been reading her since I've been out here. Richard turned me on to her. She wrote a little book about what it was like, about what she was thinking and feeling the whole time she had this fever. Sometimes her temperature was 102. Sometimes it was lower. Maybe it went higher than 102. But 102 was the highest she ever took her temperature and wrote, too, when she had the fever. Anyway, she wrote about it. That's what I'm saying. Try writing about what it's like. Something might come of it, Eileen said, and inexplicably, it seemed to Carlyle, she laughed. At least later on you'd have an hour-by-hour account of your sickness to look back at. At least you'd have that to show for it. Right now you've just got this discomfort. You've got to translate that into something usable.
He pressed his fingertips against his temple and shut his eyes, but she was still on the line, waiting for him to say something. What could he say? It was clear to him that she was insane.
Jesus, he said. Jesus, Eileen, I don't know what to say to that. I really don't. I have to go now. Thanks for calling, he said. It's all right, she said. We have to be able to communicate. Kiss the kids for me. Tell them I love them. And Richard sends his hellos to you, even though he's flat on his back.
Goodbye, Carlyle said, and hung up. Then he brought his hands to his face. He remembered, for some reason, seeing the fat girl make the same gesture that time as she moved toward the car. He lowered his hands and looked at Mrs. Webster, who was watching him.
"Not bad news, I hope," she said.
The old woman had moved a chair near to where he sat on the sofa. Carlyle shook his head.
"Good,"
Mrs. Webster said.
"That's good. Now, Mr. Carlyle, this may not be the best time in the world to talk about this."
She glanced out to the dining room. At the table, the children had their heads bent over the clay.
But since it has to be talked about sometime soon, and since it concerns you and the children, and you're up now, I have something to tell you. Jim and I, we're getting on. The thing is, we need something more than we have at the present. Do you know what I'm saying? This is hard for me, she said, and shook her head.
Carlyle nodded slowly. He knew that she was going to tell him she had to leave. He wiped his face on his sleeve.
Jim's son by a former marriage, Bob, the man is 40 years old, called yesterday to invite us to go out to Oregon and help him with his mink ranch. Jim would be doing whatever they do with minks, and I'd cook, buy the groceries, clean house, and do anything else that needed doing. It's a chance for both of us, and it's board and room and then some. Jim and I won't have to worry any more about what's going to happen to us. You know what I'm saying? Right now, Jim doesn't have anything, she said. He was 62 last week. He hasn't had anything for some time. He came in this morning to tell you about it himself, because I was going to have to give notice, you see. I thought it would help if Jim was here when I told you.
She waited for Carlyle to say something. When he didn't, she went on.
I'll finish out the week, and I could stay on a couple of days next week if need be. But then, you know, for sure, we really have to leave, and you'll have to wish us luck. I mean, can you imagine? All the way out there to Oregon in that old rattle-trap of ours? But I'm going to miss these little kids. They're so precious.
After a time, when he still hadn't moved to answer her, she got up from her chair and went to sit on the cushion next to his. She touched the sleeve of his robe.
Mr. Carlyle?
I understand, he said. I want you to know your being here has made a big difference to me and the children. His head ached so much that he had to squint his eyes. This headache, he said, this headache is killing me. Mrs. Webster reached over and laid the back of her hand against his forehead.
"You still have some fever," she told him. "I'll get more aspirin. That'll help bring it down. I'm still on the case here," she said. "I'm still the doctor."
"My wife thinks I should write down what this feels like," Carlyle said. "She thinks it might be a good idea to describe what the fever is like, so I can look back later and get the message." He laughed. Some tears came to his eyes. He wiped them away with the heel of his hand.
"I think I'll get your aspirin and juice and then go out there with the kids," Mrs. Webster said.
Looks to me like they've about worn out their interest with that clay."
Carlyle was afraid she'd move into the other room and leave him alone. He wanted to talk to her. He cleared his throat. "Mrs. Webster, there's something I want you to know. For a long time, my wife and I loved each other more than anything or anybody in the world, and that includes those children. We thought, well, we knew that we'd grow old together, and we knew we'd do all the things in the world that we wanted to do and do them together." He shook his head. That seemed the saddest thing of all to him now, that whatever they did from now on, each would do it without the other.
"There, it's all right," Mrs. Webster said. She patted his hand.
He sat forward and began to talk again. After a time, the children came out to the living room. Mrs. Webster caught their attention and held a finger to her lips. Carlyle looked at them and went on talking. "Let them listen," he thought. "It concerns them, too." The children seemed to understand they had to remain quiet, even pretend some interest, so they sat down next to Mrs. Webster's legs. Then they got down on their stomachs on the carpet and started to giggle. But Mrs. Webster looked sternly in their direction, and that stopped it. Carlyle went on talking. At first his head still ached, and he felt awkward to be in his pajamas on the sofa with this old woman beside him, waiting patiently for him to go on to the next thing. But then his headache went away, and soon he stopped feeling awkward and forgot how he was supposed to feel. He had begun his story somewhere in the middle, after the children were born. But then he backed up and started at the beginning, back when Eileen was 18 and he was 19, a boy and a girl in love, burning with it. He stopped to wipe his forehead. He moistened his lips.
"Go on," Mrs. Webster said. "I know what you're saying. You just keep talking, Mr. Carlyle. Sometimes it's good to talk about it. Sometimes it has to be talked about. Besides, I want to hear it, and you're going to feel better afterwards. Something just like it happened to me once. Something like what you're describing. Love, that's what it is."
The children fell asleep on the carpet. Keith had his thumb in his mouth.
Carlyle was still talking when Mr. Webster came to the door, knocked, and then stepped inside to collect Mrs. Webster.
"Sit down, Jim," Mrs. Webster said. "There's no hurry. Go on with what you were saying, Mr. Carlyle."
Carlyle nodded at the old man, and the old man nodded back, then got himself one of the dining-room chairs and carried it into the living-room. He brought the chair close to the sofa and sat down on it with a sigh. Then he took off his cap and wearily lifted one leg over the other. When Carlyle began talking again, the old man put both feet on the floor. The children woke up. They sat up on the carpet and rolled their heads back and forth. But by then, Carlyle had said all he knew to say, so he stopped talking.
"Good. Good for you,"
Mrs. Webster said when she saw he had finished.
"You're made out of good stuff. And so is she. So is Mrs. Carlyle. And don't you forget it. You're both going to be okay after this is over."
She got up and took off the apron she'd been wearing. Mr. Webster got up, too, and put his cap back on. At the door, Carlyle shook hands with both of the Websters.
"So long,"
Jim Webster said. He touched the bill of his cap. "Good luck to you," Carlyle said. Mrs. Webster said she'd see him in the morning then, bright and early, as always. As if something important had been settled, Carlyle said, "Right." The old couple went carefully along the walk and got into their truck. Jim Webster bent down under the dashboard. Mrs. Webster looked at Carlyle and waved. It was then, as he stood at the window, that he felt something come to an end. It had to do with Eileen and the life before this. Had he ever waved at her? He must have, of course. He knew he had, yet he could not remember just now. But he understood it was over, and he felt able to let her go.
He was sure their life together had happened in the way he said it had, but it was something that had passed, and that passing, though it had seemed impossible, and he'd fought against it, would become a part of him now, too, as surely as anything else he'd left behind. As the pickup lurched forward, he lifted his arm once more. He saw the old couple lean toward him briefly as they drove away. Then he brought his arm down and turned to his children. The Bridle. This old station wagon with Minnesota plates pulls into a parking space in front of the window. There's a man and woman in the front seat, two boys in the back. It's July, temperature's 100+. These people look whipped. There are clothes hanging inside, suitcases, boxes, and such piled in back. From what Harley and I put together later, that's all they had left after the bank in Minnesota took their house, their pickup, their tractor, the farm implements, and a few cows. The people inside sit for a minute as if collecting themselves. The air conditioner in our apartment is going full blast. Harley's around in back cutting grass. There's some discussion in the front seat, and then she and him get out and start for the front door. I pat my hair to make sure that it's in place and wait till they push the doorbell for the second time. Then I go to let them in. "You're looking for an apartment?" I say. "Come on in here where it's cool." I show them into the living room. The living room is where I do business. It's where I collect the rents, write the receipts, and talk to interested parties. I also do hair. I call myself a stylist. That's what my cards say. I don't like the word beautician. It's an old-time word. I have the chair in a corner of the living room and a dryer I can pull up to the back of the chair. And there's a sink that Harley put in a few years ago. Alongside the chair I have a table with some magazines. The magazines are old, the covers are gone from some of them, but people will look at anything while they're under the dryer. The man says his name. "My name is Hollitz." He tells me she's his wife, but she won't look at me. She looks at her nails instead. She and Hollitz won't sit down, either. He says they're interested in one of the furnished units. "How many of you?" But I'm just saying what I always say. I know how many. I saw the two boys in the back seat. 2 and 2 is 4. "Me and her and the boys. The boys are 13 and 14, and they'll share a room like always." She has her arms crossed and is holding the sleeves of her blouse. She takes in the chair and the sink as if she's never seen their like before. Maybe she hasn't. "I do hair," I say. She nods. Then she gives my prayer plant the once-over. It has exactly 5 leaves to it. "That needs watering," I say. I go over and touch one of its leaves. Everything around here needs water. There's not enough water in the air. It rains 3 times a year if we're lucky. But you'll get used to it. We had to get used to it, but everything here is air-conditioned. "How much is the place?" Hollitz wants to know. I tell him, and he turns to her to see what she thinks. But he may as well have been looking at the wall. She won't give him back his look. "I guess we'll have you show us," he says. So I move to get the key for 17, and we go outside. I hear Harley before I see him. Then he comes into sight between the buildings. He's moving along behind the power mower in his Bermudas and T-shirt, wearing the straw hat he bought in Nogales. He spends his time cutting grass and doing the small maintenance work. We work for a corporation, Fulton Terrace Incorporated. They own the place. If anything major goes wrong, like air conditioning trouble or something serious in the plumbing department, we have a list of phone numbers. I wave. I have to. Harley takes a hand off the mower handle and signals. Then he pulls the hat down over his forehead and gives his attention back to what he's doing. He comes to the end of his cut, makes his turn, and starts back toward the street. "That's Harley," I have to shout it. We go in at the side of the building and up some stairs. "What kind of work are you in, Mr. Hollitz?" I ask him. "He's a farmer," she says. "No more." "Not much to farm around here," I say it without thinking. "We had us a farm in Minnesota, raised wheat, a few cattle, and Hollitz knows horses. He knows everything there is about horses." "That's all right, Betty." I get a piece of the picture then. Hollitz is unemployed. It's not my affair, and I feel sorry if that's the case. It is, it turns out. But as we stop in front of the unit, I have to say something. If you decide, it's first month, last month, and 150 as security deposit. I look down at the pool as I say it. Some people are sitting in deck chairs, and there's somebody in the water. Hollitz wipes his face with the back of his hand. Harley's mower is clacking away. Farther off, cars speed by on Calle Verde. The two boys have got out of the station wagon. One of them is standing at military attention, legs together, arms at his sides. But as I watch, I see him begin to flap his arms up and down and jump, like he intends to take off and fly. The other one is squatting down on the driver's side of the station wagon, doing knee bends. I turn to Hollitz. "Let's have a look," he says. I turn the key and the door opens. It's just a little two-bedroom furnished apartment. Everybody has seen dozens. Hollitz stops in the bathroom long enough to flush the toilet. He watches till the tank fills. Later, he says, "This could be our room." He's talking about the bedroom that looks out over the pool. In the kitchen, the woman takes hold of the edge of the drain board and stares out the window. "That's the swimming pool," I say. She nods. "We stayed in some motels that had swimming pools, but in one pool they had too much chlorine in the water." I wait for her to go on, but that's all she says. I can't think of anything else either.
"I guess we won't waste any more time. I guess we'll take it."
Hollitz looks at her as he says it. This time she meets his eyes. She nods. He lets out breath through his teeth. Then she does something. She begins snapping her fingers. One hand is still holding the edge of the drain board, but with her other hand she begins snapping her fingers. Snap, 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 like she was calling her dog, or else trying to get someone's attention. Then she stops and runs her nails across the counter. I don't know what to make of it. Hollitz doesn't either. He moves his feet. "We'll walk back to the office and make things official," I say. "I'm glad." I was glad. We had a lot of empty units for this time of year, and these people seemed like dependable people, down on their luck, that's all. No disgrace can be attached to that. Hollitz pays in cash. First, last, and the 150 deposit. He counts out bills of $50 denomination while I watch. U.S. grants, Harley calls them, though he's never seen many. I write out the receipt and give him two keys. "You're all set." He looks at the keys. He hands her one.
"Somewhere in Arizona. Never thought you'd see Arizona, did you?"
She shakes her head. She's touching one of the prayer plant leaves.
"Needs water," I say. She lets go of the leaf and turns to the window. I go over next to her. Harley is still cutting grass, but he's around in front now. There's been this talk of farming, so for a minute I think of Harley moving along behind a plow instead of behind his Black & Decker power mower. I watch them unload their boxes, suitcases, and clothes. Hollitz carries in something that has straps hanging from it. It takes a minute, but then I figure out it's a bridle. I don't know what to do next. I don't feel like doing anything, so I take the grants out of the cash box. I just put them in there, but I take them out again. The bills have come from Minnesota. Who knows where they'll be this time next week? They could be in Las Vegas. All I know about Las Vegas is what I see on TV, about enough to put into a thimble. I can imagine one of the Grants finding its way out to Waikiki Beach, or else some other place, Miami or New York City, New Orleans. I think about one of those bills changing hands during Mardi Gras. They could go any place, and anything could happen because of 'em. I write my name in ink across Grant's broad old forehead. Marge. I print it. I do it on every one, right over his thick brows. People will stop in the midst of their spending and wonder, "Who's this Marge?" That's what they'll ask themselves. "Who's this Marge?" Harley comes in from outside and washes his hands in my sink. He knows it's something I don't like him to do, but he goes ahead and does it anyway. "Those people from Minnesota," he says, "the Swedes, they're a long way from home." He dries his hands on a paper towel. He wants me to tell him what I know, but I don't know anything. They don't look like Swedes, and they don't talk like Swedes. "They're not Swedes," I tell him, but he acts like he doesn't hear me.
"So what's he do?"
"He's a farmer."
"What do you know about that?"
Harley takes his hat off and puts it on my chair. He runs a hand through his hair. Then he looks at the hat and puts it on again. He may as well be glued to it.
"There's not much to farm around here. Did you tell him that?"
He gets a can of soda pop from the fridge and goes to sit in his recliner. He picks up the remote control, pushes something, and the TV sizzles on. He pushes some more buttons until he finds what he's looking for. It's a hospital show.
"What else does the Swede do, besides farm?"
I don't know, so I don't say anything. But Harley's already taken up with his program. He's probably forgotten he asked me the question. A siren goes off. I hear the screech of tires. On the screen, an ambulance has come to a stop in front of an emergency room entrance, its red lights flashing. A man jumps out and runs around to open up the back. The next afternoon, the boys borrow the hose and wash the station wagon. They clean the outside and the inside. A little later, I notice her drive away. She's wearing high heels and a nice dress. Hunting up a job, I'd say. After a while, I see the boys messing around the pool in their bathing suits. One of them springs off the board and swims all the way to the other end underwater. He comes up blowing water and shaking his head. The other boy, the one who'd been doing knee bends the day before, lies on his stomach on a towel at the far side of the pool. But this one boy keeps swimming back and forth from one end of the pool to the other, touching the wall and turning back with a little kick. There are two other people out there. They're in lounge chairs, one on either side of the pool. One of them is Irving Cobb, a cook at Denny's. He calls himself Spuds. People have taken to calling him that, Spuds, instead of Irv or some other nickname. Spuds is 55 and bald. He already looks like beef jerky, but he wants more sun. Right now his new wife, Linda Cobb, is at work at the Kmart. Spuds works nights, but him and Linda Cobb have it arranged so they take their Saturdays and Sundays off. Connie Nova is in the other chair. She's sitting up and rubbing lotion on her legs. She's nearly naked. Just this little two-piece suit covering her. Connie Nova is a cocktail waitress. She moved in here 6 months ago with her so-called fiancé, an alcoholic lawyer. But she got rid of him. Now she lives with a long-haired student from the college whose name is Rick. I happen to know he's away right now visiting his folks. Spuds and Connie are wearing dark glasses. Connie's portable radio is going. Spuds was a recent widower when he moved in a year or so back, but after a few months of being a bachelor again, he got married to Linda. She's a red-haired woman in her 30s. I don't know how they met, but one night a couple of months ago, Spuds and the new Mrs. Cobb had Harley and me over to a nice dinner that Spuds fixed. After dinner, we sat in their living room drinking sweet drinks out of big glasses. Spuds asked if we wanted to see home movies. We said sure. so Spuds set up his screen and his projector. Linda Cobb poured us more of that sweet drink. Where's the harm? I asked myself. Spuds began to show films of a trip he and his dead wife had made to Alaska. It began with her getting on the plane in Seattle. Spuds talked as he ran the projector. The deceased was in her 50s, good-looking, though maybe a little heavy. Her hair was nice.
That's Spuds' first wife, Linda Cobb said. That's the first Mrs. Cobb.
That's Evelyn, Spuds said. The first wife stayed on the screen for a long time. It was funny seeing her and hearing them talk about her like that. Harley passed me a look, so I know he was thinking something, too. Linda Cobb asked if we wanted another drink or a macaroon. We didn't. Spuds was saying something about the first Mrs. Cobb again. She was still at the entrance to the plane, smiling and moving her mouth, even if all you could hear was the film going through the projector. People had to go around her to get on the plane. She kept waving at the camera, waving at us there in Spuds's living room. She waved and waved.
"There's Evelyn again," the new Mrs. Cobb would say, each time the first Mrs. Cobb appeared on the screen.
Spuds would have shown films all night, but we said we had to go. Harley made the excuse. I don't remember what he said. Connie Nova is lying on her back in the chair, dark glasses covering half her face. Her legs and stomach shine with oil. One night, not long after she moved in, she had a party. This was before she kicked the lawyer out and took up with the long hair. She called her party a housewarming. Harley and I were invited, along with a bunch of other people. We went, but we didn't care for the company. We found a place to sit close to the door, and that's where we stayed till we left. It wasn't all that long, either. Connie's boyfriend was giving a door prize. It was the offer of his legal services, without charge, for the handling of a divorce. Anybody's divorce. Anybody who wanted to could draw a card out of the bowl he was passing around. When the bowl came our way, everybody began to laugh. Harley and I swapped glances. I didn't draw. Harley didn't draw either. But I saw him look in the bowl at the pile of cards. Then he shook his head and handed the bowl to the person next to him. Even Spuds and the new Mrs. Cobb drew cards. The winning card had something written across the back. Entitles bearer to one free, uncontested divorce. And the lawyer's signature and the date. The lawyer was a drunk, but I say this is no way to conduct your life. Everybody but us had put his hand into the bowl like it was a fun thing to do. The woman who drew the winning card clapped. It was like one of those game shows.
Goddamn, this is the first time I ever won anything.
I was told she had a husband in the military. There's no way of knowing if she still has him or if she got her divorce, because Connie Nova took up with a different set of friends after she and the lawyer went their separate ways. We left the party right after the drawing. It made such an impression we couldn't say much, except one of us said, I don't believe I saw what I think I saw. Maybe I said it. A week later, Harley asks if the Swede, he means Hollitz, has found work yet. We've just had lunch, and Harley is in his chair with his can of pop. But he hasn't turned his TV on. I say, I don't know, and I don't. I wait to see what else he has to say, but he doesn't say anything else. He shakes his head. He seems to think about something. Then he pushes a button and the TV comes to life. She finds a job. She starts working as a waitress in an Italian restaurant a few blocks from here. She works a split shift, doing lunches and then going home, then back to work again in time for the dinner shift. She's meeting herself coming and going. The boys swim all day while Hollitz stays inside the apartment. I don't know what he does in there. Once I did her hair, and she told me a few things. She told me she did waitressing when she was just out of high school, and that's where she met Hollitz. She served him some pancakes in a place back in Minnesota. She'd walked down that morning and asked me if I could do her a favor. She wanted me to fix her hair after her lunch shift and have her out in time for her dinner shift. Could I do it? I told her I'd check the book. I asked her to step inside. It must have been 100 degrees already.
I know it's short notice, she said, but when I came in from work last night, I looked in the mirror and saw my roots showing. I said to myself, I need a treatment. I don't know where else to go.
I find Friday, August 14. There's nothing on the page. I could work you in at 2:30 or else at 3 o'clock, I say.
3 would be better, she says. I have to run for it now before I'm late. I work for a real bastard. See you later.
At 2:30, I tell Harley I have a customer, so he'll have to take his baseball game into the bedroom. He grumps, but he winds up the cord and wheels the set out back. He closes the door. I make sure everything I need is ready. I fix up the magazines so they're easy to get to. Then I sit next to the dryer and file my nails. I'm wearing the rose-colored uniform that I put on when I do hair. I go on filing my nails and looking up at the window from time to time. She walks by the window and then pushes the doorbell. Come in, I call. It's unlocked. She's wearing the black and white uniform from her job. I can see how we're both wearing uniforms. Sit down, honey, and we'll get started. She looks at the nail file. I give manicures, too, I say. She settles into the chair and draws a breath. I say, put your head back. That's it. Close your eyes now, why don't you? Just relax. First I'll shampoo you and touch up these roots here. Then we'll go from there. How much time do you have?
I have to be back there at 5:30.
We'll get you fixed up. I can eat at work, but I don't know what Hollitz and the boys will do for their supper. They'll get along fine without you. I start the warm water and then notice Harley's left me some dirt and grass. I wipe up his mess and start over. I say, if they want, they could just walk down the street to the hamburger place. It won't hurt them.
They won't do that. Anyway, I don't want them to have to go there.
It's none of my business, so I don't say any more.
I make up a nice lather and go to work. After I've done the shampoo, rinse, and set, I put her under the dryer. Her eyes have closed. I think she could be asleep. So I take one of her hands and begin.
No manicure.
She opens her eyes and pulls away her hand. It's all right, honey. The first manicure is always no charge. She gives me back her hand and picks up one of the magazines and rests it in her lap.
They're his boys, she says, from his first marriage. He was divorced when we met. But I love them like they were my own. I couldn't love them any more if I tried, not even if I was their natural mother.
I turn the dryer down a notch so that it's making a low, quiet sound. I keep on with her nails. Her hand starts to relax.
She lit out on them, on Hollitz and the boys, on New Year's Day 10 years ago. They never heard from her again.
I can see she wants to tell me about it, and that's fine with me. They like to talk when they're in the chair. I go on using the file.
Hollis got the divorce. Then he and I started going out. Then we got married. For a long time we had us a life. It had its ups and downs, but we thought we were working toward something.
She shakes her head.
But something happened. Something happened to Hollis, I mean.
One thing happened was he got interested in horses. This one particular racehorse. He bought it, you know. Something down, something each month. He took it around to the tracks. He was still up before daylight, like always, still doing the chores and such. I thought everything was all right. But I don't know anything. If you want the truth, I'm not so good at waiting tables. I think those wops would fire me at the drop of a hat if I gave them a reason. Or for no reason. What if I got fired? Then what?
I say, don't worry, honey. They're not going to fire you.
Pretty soon she picks up another magazine. But she doesn't open it. She just holds it and goes on talking.
Anyway, there's this horse of his, Fast Betty.
The Betty part is a joke, but he says it can't help but be a winner if he names it after me. A big winner, all right. The fact is, wherever it ran, it lost. Every race. Betty Longshot, that's what it should have been called. In the beginning, I went to a few races, but the horse always ran 99-1. Odds like that. But Hollitz is stubborn, if he's anything. He wouldn't give up. He bet on the horse and bet on the horse, $20 to win, $50 to win, plus all the other things it costs for keeping a horse. I know it don't sound like a large amount, but it adds up. And when the odds were like that, 99-1, you know, sometimes he'd buy a combination ticket. He'd ask me if I realized how much money we'd make if the horse came in. But it didn't, and I quit going. I keep on with what I'm doing. I concentrate on her nails. You have nice cuticles, I say. Look here at your cuticles. See these little half moons? Means your blood's good. She brings her hand up close and looks. What do you know about that? She shrugs. She lets me take her hand again. She's still got things to tell. Once, when I was in high school, a counselor asked me to come to her office. She did it with all the girls, one of us at a time. What dreams do you have? This woman asked me. What do you see yourself doing in 10 years, 20 years? I was 16 or 17. I was just a kid. I couldn't think what to answer. I just sat there like a lump. This counselor was about the age I am now. I thought she was old. She's old, I said to myself. I knew her life was half over, and I felt like I knew something she didn't, something she'd never know, a secret, something nobody's supposed to know or ever talk about. So I stayed quiet. I just shook my head. She must have written me off as a dope. But I couldn't say anything. You know what I mean? I thought I knew things she couldn't guess at. Now if anybody asked me that question again, about my dreams and all, I'd tell them. What would you tell them, honey? I have her other hand now, but I'm not doing her nails. I'm just holding it, waiting to hear. She moves forward in the chair. She tries to take her hand back. What would you tell them? She sighs and leans back. She lets me keep the hand. I'd say, dreams, you know, are what you wake up from. That's what I'd say. She smooths the lap of her skirt. If anybody asked, that's what I'd say. But they won't ask. She lets out her breath again. So how much longer? She says. Not long, I say. You don't know what it's like. Yes, I do, I say. I pull the stool right up next to her legs. I'm starting to tell her how it was before we moved here, and how it's still like that. But Harley picks right then to come out of the bedroom. He doesn't look at us. I hear the TV jabbering away in the bedroom. He goes to the sink and draws a glass of water. He tips his head back to drink. His Adam's apple moves up and down in his throat. I move the dryer away and touch the hair at both sides of her head. I lift one of the curls just a little. I say, you look brand new, honey. Don't I wish? The boys keep on swimming all day, every day, till their school starts. Betty keeps on at her job. But for some reason, she doesn't come back to get her hair done. I don't know why this is. Maybe she doesn't think I did a good job. Sometimes I lie awake, Harley sleeping like a grindstone beside me, and try to picture myself in Betty's shoes. I wonder what I'd do then. Hollitz sends one of his sons with the rent on the 1st of September and on the 1st of October, too. He still pays in cash. I take the money from the boy, count the bills right there in front of him, and then write out the receipt. Hollitz has found work of some sort. I think so, anyway. He drives off every day with the station wagon. I see him leave early in the morning and drive back late in the afternoon. She goes past the window at 10:30 and comes back at 3:00.